proven incompetent misfits through the system and allowed them to lead platoons in combat. The events at My Lai reflected the inadequacy to the point of total absence of senior leadership all the way up Cali's chain of command. As Colonel Lucian K. Truscott III, son of World War II's fighting General Truscott, wrote, "Would My Lai have happened if Coster, Division CG, and Henderson, Brigade CO, and Barker, Battalion CO, all of whom have claimed that they saw and heard nothing, had been down on the ground where the killing was going on? And in that the men whose careers stood to be least enhanced by the events at My Lai actively suppressed information, or even worse, simply closed their eyes to cover their own asses instead of immediately and severely punishing the participants in the massacre, My Lai reflected a tragic bankruptcy of moral fiber in the Army's senior officer corps, a direct result of rampant careerism. To me, all this was bad enough. But then, when the Army actually had the balls to stand in the door and convict Cali for murder, to have Richard Nixon come along and for purely political ends interfere with military justice and essentially nullify the result was too much for me. The kid was guilty as hell. Having judged him so, the Army had to start addressing its own inadequacies to find out how it could have allowed such a leader to get through the system in the first place. But Nixon's action was an out, as good as excusing the Army from even beginning that self-examination. Fundamentally, it was the worst thing that could have happened since My Lai itself. So that was one thing that pushed me in the direction of going public. As for the second, the attendant rumor to Hunt's being picked up below the zone to Major General was that he was going all the way, that this man would one day be Chief of Staff. It was once an eagle all over again, and I was horrified. It was as if I'd climbed to the highest rung of the ladder only to find that the ladder was leaning against the wrong wall. If Hunt was what the Army now considered a stud, the kind of man to lead it into the 80s, then as far as I was concerned, the Army had been lying to itself for so long about so much that it had totally lost perspective of reality. So I got in touch with Howard Tuckner. 2 days later, he and his ABC boss, Nick George, were in Khao Lan, and for some 16 hours we discussed the content of the interview, which was to be filmed the following day and aired on ABC TV's Issues and Answers in early July, after my tour was over and I was out of Vietnam. It was almost midnight when we finished up, and I found myself all alone and scared to death. I wrote to Jenny, "That TV camera will be worse than facing a platoon of machine guns. We'll try not to be too abrasive, but I want to speak the truth of what is happening in Vietnam. If my efforts save one life, then it will be worthwhile." In the morning, the crew arrived. Howitt was there, and Willis and Tuckner, who chatted with me while the crew set up, and I tried to hold my apprehension at bay. Just as everything was ready, and I was about to sit down in front of that television camera, one of my commo men brought in a back-channel message for me. It was from Hank Emerson in the United States, and it was an invitation to be his deputy for a new leadership study group designed to find out what the hell was wrong with the U.S. Army. Westmoreland had already approved my appointment. The timing of Hank's offer was most incredible. If that back channel had arrived the day before, I would have canceled the show, no question about it. As it was, I was at a complete loss. Was it fate? God's 11th hour way of saying I was making a mistake, that I should stay and fight from within and not thumb my nose at my lifeblood, especially this way by speaking out in Vietnam in uniform? I told Tuckner I'd needed some time to think. But when I thought, all I could think of, despite Hank and despite his exceptional way of making things happen when everything else was letting them slide, was Westy's study in 68. In good faith, I'd contributed to that report as one of 16 of the supposedly sharpest studs in the Army. 3 years later, it had changed nothing. After that experience, why I believed that as an individual I somehow had the authority to bring those in power to their senses, I didn't know. But I did believe it. I truly believed that by going outside channels directly to the American people, I could make these guys think and bring about change. So in the end, despite Hank's offer, there was not much of a decision to be made. And so the camera began to roll. 22. Issues and Answers. Sunday, 27 June, 1971. This is a direct transcript of the ABC Issues and Answers interview aired nationwide in the United States on Sunday, 27 June, 1971. No editing or corrections in grammar have been made in the text. Guest, Colonel David H. Hackworth, U.S. Army. Interviewed by Howard Tuckner, ABC News Saigon correspondent. Mr. Tuckner. You have served in Korea, you have served in Vietnam for a long time, you have served back at the Pentagon. How do you rate the training of U.S. Army troops who came to Vietnam? Colonel Hackworth. I think in the main, the training for Vietnam from the standpoint of the individual soldier, the young soldier, and even the battalion, brigade, and division staff officers and senior commanders has been totally inadequate. I think that our training was geared to the individual replacement system of World War II. The curriculum was wrong. The quality of the instructors and the leaders was, in my judgment, we didn't have the type people that should have been there. The commanders there should have been, the battalion commanders should have commanded battalions in Vietnam. The company commanders should have commanded companies here, and leaders should have been the finest leaders our country could have mustered to provide the young soldiers with the type training, the realistic training that they needed to confront a guerrilla enemy in Vietnam. And I'd like to just make the point that when my well-trained STRAC, one of the finest units in the U.S. Army, arrived in Vietnam in June and July of 1965, the mistakes they made were criminal. The number of dead that they have killed among themselves, men that were shot by their comrades, artillery that had fallen on them, great mistakes were made because of improper training, being not prepared for the war, even though we had from 1953 to 1965 to prepare for the war. Mr. Tuckner. In your view, did poor training lead to higher casualties in Vietnam? Colonel Hackworth. I am convinced of it. I think that our casualties were at least 30% higher because of, or even higher than that, but I'd say, just safely, 30% higher because of troops that were not properly trained. I participated in a study group in the Pentagon in 67 and early 68, which considered U.S. casualties caused by friendly fires, and the group was composed of highly experienced personnel that had served in Vietnam, and it was our conclusion that 15 to 20% of the casualties caused in Vietnam were the result of friendly fire, one man shooting another man, artillery, friendly artillery firing on a friendly element, friendly helicopters firing on a friendly unit, TAC air striking a friendly unit. And I could count you, in my own case, countless personal examples. For example, during the Battle of Doc To, June the 17th, a rocket ship came into my A Company's position by mistake and released its rockets right on top of the company, killing the executive officer and wounding 29 other troopers. I can recall in September of 1965, as my battalion was deployed, artillery was fired in the wrong place, killing 7 men in one of my platoons. Mr. Tuckner. Can it be said that the generals in the U.S. Army, many of them, did not really adjust to the tactics of this war? Colonel Hackworth. I think the average general that came to Vietnam did not have a good concept, good appreciation of the nature of guerrilla warfare. In most cases, because of their lack of even reading in depth about guerrilla warfare, they were not prepared for the war, and they had to fall back on Korea and World War II. And they used the thought process and the techniques that worked successfully there, moving in large formations, making battalion and brigade air mobile assaults on a small LZ, and having everything very tidy, artillery in position and fighting much as we did on the plains of Europe. I don't feel that too many division commanders or even separate brigade commanders really understood the name of the game. Mr. Tuckner. Did this mean more U.S. casualties, this misunderstanding of the name of the game, as you put it? Colonel Hackworth. Absolutely, absolutely. I think probably one of the most classic examples is Hamburger Hill. Here was a hill that had to be taken. Hundreds and hundreds of casualties occurred taking this hill. They had the hill for a few days, the Americans did, and pulled off. So what was the point of taking the hill? Why not stand back if the enemy is on it and bomb? Why use the infantry to take the hill? Mr. Tuckner. Did the upper echelon of the army really ever become changed on this war? Did they learn from their mistakes? Colonel Hackworth. I don't think so. I don't think that the top level ever developed a realistic strategic plan, nor did they ever have tactics to support that strategic plan. Mr. Tuckner. Why? Colonel Hackworth. I think that the top managers of the Army, and there is a big difference between a leader, a combat leader, and a manager, the top managers were so involved in systems analysis, in the normal bureaucracy of it all, that they were fighting from day to day just to move the paper that crossed their desk, and they couldn't see the forest for the trees. In February, when we went into Laos conventionally. The idea was to block the enemy's supply routes, so we dropped in there. We paid a horrible, the Vietnamese paid a horrible price. Tremendous mistakes were made. Again, conventional thinking. Conventional thinking put us on that operation rather than having a light mobile guerrilla force, but a guerrilla force that belonged to the government of Vietnam, or the American Army operating in there like guerrillas. It takes a thief to catch a thief. What we need is a thief. We don't need a conventionally trained FBI agent dashing through the woods with a large force behind him. We need small, well-trained, highly motivated, and this is what we have not had, because what we have now among the Army is a bunch of shallow dilettantes who run from pillar to post trying to punch their card, serving minimum time at company level because the exposure, you are very close to the heat of the furnace there, meaning you can get in trouble easily. Mr. Tuckner. Have you found that many other U.S. Army officers who have been here in Vietnam feel the way you do? Colonel Hackworth. Most of my young friends, that would be captains, majors, and lieutenant colonels, who have a considerable amount of experience in Vietnam feel as I do. A number of very highly qualified full colonels whom I know feel as I do. And I suppose there are a few generals who feel as I do, but in the main, this group, unfortunately, I suppose it is because of the nature of the beast, is not highly vocal regarding their views, because if one would become highly vocal, you might become a Billy Mitchell. It might be the end of your career. Mr. Tuckner. Hasn't this silence meant that some who have died in this war might have been saved? Colonel Hackworth. That is right. And that is why perhaps we who have not been vocal should be charged for just criminal neglect, because it is our obligation, it is our responsibility, not only to train our soldiers well, to lead our soldiers well, but to make sure that there are no mistakes made, that they are protected as well as possible from mistakes and error, and once you make mistakes, they must be surfaced, critiqued, identified, and remedial action taken. Mr. Tuckner. Colonel, I understand that because of the fact that you are considered one of the best infantry officers in the Army, you have been asked a number of times to go to the War College, which is preparation for becoming general one day. Colonel Hackworth. Yes, I have been asked to go to War College for 3 years straight, and my reason for refusing is that I just simply felt that we were on the battlefield. We were engaged in a critical battle, and I didn't need to go to school at the time to learn anything. I was learning it on the battlefield, and I was transferring the skills that I had to my men and probably saving lives. I can recall in November 1969, a major general here in Vietnam told me that when I asked him, should I extend again, he said, Hack, get out. The war for the U.S. Army is over with in Vietnam. He said, you've got all the right tickets and all the right credentials. Go on to War College now and prepare yourself for bigger things. Mr. Tuckner. Colonel, we have heard a lot about body count in this war. What about it? Colonel Hackworth. Well, it has been used as a rule of measurement of success. The body count has cost us a lot. It has cost us unnecessary casualties because always in the chain of command, one commander is pressuring the other commander for what is the success, what is the body count, and it ends up you are calling the platoon leader, how many have you killed? The platoon leader is in a firefight, and he hasn't a clue of how many he has killed, but he may have to stop the fight. He may have to expose a few soldiers to go out and count the bodies during the fight. He may lose the momentum of the attack to stay on the enemy and pursue him while he is counting bodies. He may have to squat on the enemy and count the bodies. It also has really weakened the moral fiber of the officer corps because it has taught them to lie. It has taught them to exaggerate because, again, it is a form of success. It is, how many touchdowns do you have? What is the final score of the game? And the body count has been greatly exaggerated as a result of this, and I would say it has been exaggerated to the tune of 20 to 25%. Mr. Tuckner, do you know of any example specifically where you were involved in training to substantiate body count that you didn't think was accurate? Colonel Hackworth, yes, I could give several good examples. One which comes to mind is a battle which was fought with a great number of friendly maneuver elements, found, reputedly found, an enemy force. We encircled the enemy force. All night long, artillery, rockets, fighter bombers were placed on the enemy for us, and came the dawn when we swept the enemy positions, there was a total of enemy dead on the battlefield of not more than 20. When I crossed over to the other side of the canal that we were fighting on to talk to the commander of the other battalion, which was the other half of the encirclement force, the brigade commander came in and started talking about such a brilliant victory we had and that we killed something like 275 or 280 enemy dead. And this was a classic battle. It illustrated the techniques of mobile warfare, how we could drop on an enemy force, find them, fix them, surround them, and then destroy them. And I pointed out to the brigade commander, the acting brigade commander, I should say, that there wasn't that many dead on the battlefield. We had only killed, I would say, no more than 12 or 15, and the colonel on the other side had told me he had 6 or 7. So there couldn't have been 20 or 22 or so, and I was told there were 280 killed. Clearly, during the interview, my chronology as pertaining to the subject of body count at the Battle of My Phuoc Thai, Tan Phu, was confused. Though the count was inflated by almost one-third by Acting Brigade CO Hunt the morning after the battle, the figure of approximately 280 did not come to my attention until 6 weeks later when Hunt showed me the draft copy of his History of the Battle of Tan Phu and attempted to get my endorsement of it. Similarly, no prolonged discussion about the battle took place between Hunt and myself until that time. "This is what had been reported to division," I said. "Well, it is not right. We only had... This battalion is reported to have a strength of 300, and if we killed 280, that would leave less than 20 able-bodied men, able to remove the bodies from the battlefield," which is a normal VC technique, which was his excuse for why the bodies weren't on the battlefield. He said, "Well, that night the survivors carried them off." I said, "Look, we had the enemy completely surrounded. There was no corridor in which he could escape. If there were a small path that he could have gained escape through our lines, that would have meant that every survivor would have had to carry 7 or 8 bodies plus all their individual weapons. I think there were 5 total individual weapons found on the battlefield, and this complete battle was a total lie in my judgment." I was called in by the commander at the time to endorse his after-action report, this report which had all of these bodies in it, and great other irregularities and falsehood, I think designed to make this individual look like Rommel or look like some great tactician and very, very effective combat leader, and I refused to do it, and he and I had somewhat of a major confrontation. Also during this time, I was asked to sign a statement, a narrative statement, to support an award for the Distinguished Service Cross for this individual who didn't even get out of his helicopter during the battle, and I refused to do that. It was insinuated if I would sign 1 or 2 of these documents that I would be, my unit would be considered possibly for a unit citation as a result of this action, which I of course refused to go along with. Mr. Tuckner, did you sign it? Colonel Hackworth, absolutely not. Mr. Tuckner, when leading U.S. government officials, people like former Secretary of Defense McNamara, come to Vietnam for a visit, do they get the clear, straight picture? Colonel Hackworth, I think what we do for a presentation for a senior official such as Mr. McNamara is put on a razzle-dazzle briefing, complete with charts and extremely well-rehearsed briefing officers, and we try to put our best foot forward to try to look as good as possible. Perhaps a scenario would go kind of like this. After the briefing, Mr. McNamara turned to General Wheeler, who was with him, or to General Westmoreland, who I would think accompanied him, and said, "What do you think about that? And General Wheeler said, "Great battle. We are knocking them dead." And General Westmoreland would have said, "We really got them that time. This is a typical action in Vietnam of your U.S. modern army in action. We have really nailed them, and that is the way we are nailing them, and that is why we are winning this war. Just give us a few more troops, a few more resources, and we will have them on the run. There's light at the end of the tunnel." He didn't say the VC was holding the candle, but he said the end is in sight. So, as a consequence, Mr. McNamara, believing this, perhaps because it looked real enough to believe, went back and he is sitting, again, part of the scenario with the president, and Mr. Johnson says, "How's it going in Vietnam?" And McNamara says, "We're winning." Mr. Tuckner: "Colonel, in 1968, you were so highly thought of that you were selected from a group of a few officers to contribute to a report to General Westmoreland. What did you say in that report?" Colonel Hackworth: "Well, my comments were very exciting insofar as the Army staff was concerned. I felt that they were truthful, and I said that in my judgment at the time this paper was written in 1968, the U.S. Army had badly botched the war in Vietnam, and I had considered from a tactical standpoint we had lost the war. And now my experience 3 years later only confirms those comments to General Westmoreland." Mr. Tuckner: "What's happened since then? Has there been any change? Have your comments helped anything?" Colonel Hackworth: "No, I don't think so. I said that I felt there have been no viable reforms. I felt that the corruption that exists in Vietnam, the graft, the failure to produce, continues to exist. I felt that the military had not established any strategic goals, nor had there been any tactical concept developed to support the strategic goals which were not developed and announced. I felt that we sent an army to Vietnam that was not prepared to fight the war. We sent an army that was top-heavy in administration and logisticians and bloody thin on fighters not trained for the war. I felt that we didn't understand the nature of the war in the military. I felt that just everything we had done in Vietnam had been done wrong." Mr. Tuckner: "Do you think it is possible, Colonel, that past United States presidents who have been involved during the Vietnam War, the present administration, do you think it is possible they may feel they are getting the straight truth, but that it might not be?" Colonel Hackworth: "Well, my thing is infantry, which I am very familiar with, and I don't know what happens at the higher echelons. I know the nature of the beast in the military is to sanitize a report to look good. I have seen what has happened at brigade level where the whole situation has been distorted. I think it is highly probable that all of these beautiful briefings and excellent reports were so production line Hollywoodized that by the time they got to the president and they got to the people who were making decisions, they didn't have the real facts. They didn't understand what was happening." Mr. Tuckner: "Colonel, what do you think of the Vietnamization program? Is it viable now?" Colonel Hackworth: "Well, my view of Vietnamization is, it is a nice word. I think that it has been glamorized. I think that it has been Madison Avenued. I think that it is perhaps a PR's dream. It is a public relations gimmick. I have been with the Vietnamese a long time, and I have seen great improvements, significant improvement, but I haven't seen the improvements that I read about in many papers and different magazines, and I hear leading statesmen of our nation say, 'I don't think the Vietnamese are that good. I don't think the whole Vietnamization thing is real.'" Mr. Tuckner: "If the enemy chose to react, and if American troops were not here, what do you think would happen to the Vietnamese army?" Colonel Hackworth: "I think if the enemy had the capability of launching a concerted attack, I would think we would find ourselves in a situation as we were in 63, 64, and early 65, really, because of the American involvement here, was to save the shattered Vietnamese army. We were losing on the average of, as I recall, almost a battalion of Vietnamese a week in 65, and I think we would find the same situation developing. If the North Vietnamese, who I feel have the capability, they certainly proved they were pretty dangerous and tough up in Laos, and we find that we recently made a foray into Cambodia, and the enemy is much harder in Cambodia. Last April, the targets we were striking along my zone in Cambodia were like taking candy from a baby. Now you go to Cambodia and you find the enemy with his stuff together. He is tough. He is moving back into the areas we used to raid with ease. I think we are going to find it more and more difficult of making these raids into Cambodia. Mr. Tuckner, do you think that the programs that the U.S. military and perhaps the U.S. mission had here did not fit the situation for Vietnamization? Colonel Hackworth, exactly. We gave them a sheet of music designed by the military, and that is what they had to dance by. And the whole organization of the Vietnamese Army, in my judgment, has been wrong. It has not been tailored or designed to fight the guerrilla in this type of warfare, and we have given them a lot of sophisticated equipment, helicopters, sensor devices, radars, complicated vehicles, other complicated equipment that the Vietnamese are just incapable of using, incapable of maintaining. So we have given them now all kinds of sophisticated junk and asked them to use this. Vietnamization now will suddenly win the war because the Vietnamese have helicopters. We will suddenly win the war because the Vietnamese have the M16 rifle. But it takes a lot more than a piece of equipment or a complicated piece of equipment such as radar and sensors and so on for them to win the war. Instead of saying, what you need is well-trained soldiers, what you need is highly motivated soldiers, what you need is soldiers who are similar to the Viet Cong soldiers who are fighting for an ideal, who are fighting for something, similar to Christianity, who are fighting for a cause, a crusade, not fighting to get a Honda or get a new watch or get a portable radio or to have a nice house, but fighting for a cause, and this is what has not been inculcated in the whole Army of Vietnam. Mr. Tuckner. Colonel, do you feel it is possible you have become too emotionally involved in Vietnam? Colonel Hackworth. I have become emotionally involved in Vietnam. One couldn't have spent the number of years I have spent in Vietnam without becoming emotionally involved. One couldn't see the number of young studs die or be terribly wounded without becoming emotionally involved. I just have seen the American nation spend so much of its wonderful, great young men in this country. I have seen our national wealth being drained away. I see the nation being split apart and almost being split asunder because of this war, and I am wondering to what end is it all going to lead to. 23. A Handful of Ashes. What can we do to him? Notation on Desper Routing Slip from the Office of the Deputy Chief of Staff Personnel, 23 June 1971. Almost 2 months would pass between the filming and the airing of my Issues and Answers interview. Even so, within a week of the filming, I'd put in for retirement immediately upon completion of my zone tour, asking that the 2-year mandatory promotion requirement be waived. There was hardly anything I said to Howard Tuckner that I hadn't said before in my published articles or in discussions with or input to the Army's top brass. But when I played the unedited 3-hour tape of the interview for my team Brain Trust, their verdict was that there was no way the Army would let me get away with this most public of public airings. Not only would my orders to NATO be rescinded before the credits rolled on the television screen, suggested my friends and advisors, but no stone would go unturned in an effort to make my life as unpleasant as possible. So I applied for retirement. On one hand, the move took a great weight off my shoulders. Really feel good inside about my decision, I wrote to Jenny Bates. It is right because I feel that if you don't like something, you don't snivel and whimper about it. Sound off, express your views, be prepared for the consequences. On the other hand, I was devastated. Despite my outward bravado, I went on a bender not unlike the one that had followed my not being selected for major in Germany. Yes, I'd planned all along to get out, but not yet. I'd looked forward to those 2 years in Belgium, not only to prepare myself for civilian life, but because somehow deep inside I'd thought maybe something remarkable would happen during that period to cause me to stay in. And even though I'd said I didn't want a star or stars to join the ranks of the Hunts and the Ewells and the Massengales, I'd still thought of those stars, which I would have been proud to wear in the company of the Emersons and the Moores and the Damons. Whatever I'd said, in my head, I'd never rule out making general. On top of anything else, it would have been a hell of a good ending to the story of an orphaned kid from Santa Monica, California. And now that I most definitely would not, I actually mourned. It seems to me that Hackworth's impact on military matters would have been more significant in the military than standing outside it and criticizing. I think that his suggestions for improving the country's military preparedness would have been heeded much more if he had gone on to be a general officer. I've thought about this many times. I'm not sure his friends were his best advice and counsel back then, and he was truly asking. He hadn't made up his mind. I really think we did him and the country a disservice with our advice. Thomas O. Cooney, G4 Advisor, Executive Officer, 44th Special Tactical Zone, Republic of Vietnam, 1970-71. Having always considered money an easy-come, easy-go commodity, I've never saved a cent. Now, the most worrisome thing about my abrupt change of plans was that, with more than half my retirement pay going to child support, I was about to start a new life with an empty wallet. It wouldn't have mattered had I had a transferable skill, but what civilian jobs were designed for a 40-year-old ex-infantry colonel? I needed a grubstake, and I needed it fast. My only real talent in this area was gambling, and though I'd never actually stopped playing poker and blackjack, in my final weeks in Vietnam, I made damn sure that whenever the dealer called ante up, I was there. I relied on a number of team members to help me get my winnings out of the country. This was against MACV currency regulations. You were allowed to take out of the country, on your own behalf, only what you earned. But over the past 2 years, I'd never sent money home on my own behalf, earned or won. I'd always asked whoever on the team was going on R&R if they could just send it to Patty or Grattan, who was managing my financial affairs in the States, for me. At this point, it was virtually an SOP. Meanwhile, the war went on, with the Viet Cong seeming to be bursting with renewed life. Their main targets in the Delta were the little mud forts of the regional forces. These installations were being hit hard and on a regular basis, and for reasons unknown, were simply not hitting back. One evening, a very serious attack on an RF outpost in the zone kept me up all night trying to bring relief to the besieged position. Fortunately, we had excellent U.S. TAC air and gunship support, and Americans on the ground who were able to prevent the outpost from being overrun. The final victory was bitter, however, in that two of my men, members of Major Alan Gesselman's mobile training team who took charge and saved the day when the Viet leaders went to ground, were hit, and one of them, a fine sergeant named Meadows, died from his wounds. Regardless of the number of men I'd had die under my command, and Meadows was the last, it still got to me, and the pain was only eclipsed by the anger I felt, not just at Meadows' death, but at every American death in this war that was not our own, that had nothing to do with the security of America, and in which our sacrifices were totally unappreciated. Throughout this action, not one key Vietnamese had shown up at this joint U.S.-Viet talk to play a role or even just to find out what was happening. Drac and MACV knew full well the extent of the deteriorating RF scene, but tried their best to cover it up. The Saigon press never grabbed on the story because RF losses were not highlighted at the 5 o'clock follies, as the MACV and other high-level press briefings were known, and were of too small a scale to be headline grabbers. I got so angry over the continuing deception that I sent War Just a study I'd recently received that laid out the sorry truth of Vietnamization in the Delta. Its contents were soon made public in an article Ward wrote for the Washington Post, and the people of America could read with their own eyes that between January and April 1971, 54 Viet bases and outposts, double the figure from the previous year, had been overrun, with the attendant loss of 570 rifles, 79 radios, and enough ammo to supply a division. The reasons for the losses were many, all of which had as their root bad Viet leadership. Reading between the lines, however, all that was really happening was that the situation was reverting back to the way it had been before the Americans came in 1965. Then, if we hadn't come in, the South Vietnamese forces would have collapsed. Now that U.S. units were pulling out, it was only a question of time before that fate greeted our allies. And whatever the South Vietnamese army or the South Vietnamese government thought about that, the South Vietnamese people were ready for the inevitable. In 1965, they'd been tired. their faces etched with sorrow and fear. In 1971, the lines were only deeper, the spirits heavy with the futility of it all. Just days before I was to leave the zone for good, I visited a hamlet that had been clobbered the night before. The village chief and I sat down together to discuss what had happened, but the chief had something more on his mind. "Many years ago, I lost all my sons," he began. "That was when the French fought here. Last night, I lost my only grandson. I am the only man of my family who is still alive." "Go home, Dai Ta, Colonel. At least then we will live." Though the words stung, the chief's statement was only eloquent confirmation of something John Paul Van had told me almost a year before. "This is a funny war," he said. "When the U.S. 9th Division operated in Dinh Tuong and Kien Hoa provinces, they killed more VC than any other unit has ever done in Vietnam. But no progress was made in pacification. When the 9th left, everyone said, 'The VC will take over now.' But it hasn't happened. Just the reverse. The government now controls more. Accommodation. It's a way of life. When the Americans leave, there will be a coalition among the Vietnamese at the grassroots level. There won't be any idealism. There won't be democracy. But the people will have full bellies. The one thing both sides have going for them is they're both Vietnamese." Or, as I'd written to Raphael Benjamin while I was wrestling over whether or not to speak out, "The fight here should not be an international struggle. It is a nationalistic regional conflict, and it is unfortunate that one of the opponents is waving the red flag, because this automatically made that side the boogeyman which old Uncle Sam has apparently sworn to contain. And contain for reasons that are unclear to me. Except as a kid, I was told that the boogeyman was bad, and if I didn't come home by a certain time, he would eat me up. Think someone like Churchill convinced Sam of the same thing. So, as Ward just said, to what end?" The last time I saw David was in Saigon. He called me and asked me if I would meet him. But then he brought two or three friends of his with him. I didn't like them. It seemed to me they were influencing him, or had influenced him. Their presence was an imposition, and I didn't really like the way David was handling it, frankly. He'd always been kind of chipper, happy-go-lucky. Now he was being a little smart-ass. But the thing that impressed me about that saying goodbye was that I got the feeling he was asking me to understand. He knew I was part of the establishment. So was he, except he was rejecting it. And I got the feeling he was trying to make me understand. Colonel Harold Ace Elliott, United States Army retired. Commander, 16th MP Group, 1971. I flew to Khon Tho on my last day in the 44th zone, with veteran pilot Warrant Officer Phillips in the driver's seat. We were zipping along in a brand new 7th of the 1st Cav CNC chopper when the bird's instrument panel suddenly lit up like a pinball machine. It was definitely a four-alarm emergency, but with Phillips in charge and a fair number of chopper and airplane crashes under my belt, I wasn't too concerned. That is, until I glanced at Phillips. The pilot, who was among the coolest, most skillful aviators I knew, was absolutely ashen. "We lost our hydraulic oil." "Mayday, mayday," Phillips called into his radio mic as he turned off the chopper's engine. "Mayday, mayday," as we plummeted down, 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 like a lead anchor, right into bandit country. What an inglorious way to go, I thought, after all I'd been through. I really didn't want to die, and especially the day before I was going home for good. Just as we were about to crash, Phillips threw on all power. The engine caught at once, which broke our fall. Still, the bird crashed to the ground, the skids splaying in every direction as we tumbled out, grabbing the door guns, and went into a little perimeter to await the Viet Cong. We didn't have long to wait. Within seconds of the crash, the sky, which had been empty when Phillips first called Mayday, was filled with U.S. helicopters and airplanes coming to the rescue. They circled us, spraying holy hell out of the area, and then a chopper swooped in and scooped us up. Within 5 minutes, our broken bird was also saved, hooked out by a CH-47. Whatever else might be said about the U.S. performance in Vietnam, the Americans sure got their aviation trip together there. These guys were good. I said goodbye to General Cushman at Can Tho and received from him a max efficiency report, complete with all the requisite adjectives. This officer has applied for retirement, the general explained in his ER comments. This is an unfortunate loss to the Army. Colonel Hackworth is a brilliant officer of impressive reputation as a combat unit commander, extraordinarily innovative, and with exceptional insight into the nature of insurgency. He is a natural leader of soldiers. He attracts outstanding people, especially those of his own tiger type. He is tremendously able in a troop situation. He is an excellent organizer, writes very well, and is very widely read in his profession. He is a magnetic, driving personality. His many achievements in this current assignment include the imaginative development of effective mobile training teams for territorial forces, innovations in air mobile tactics, and major upgrading of advisory team administration and the team compound. He works very well with the Vietnamese. Colonel Hackworth is a real standout. If he were to stay in the Army, he should be given a broadening assignment outside of troop situation, working for someone he respects and could emulate, where he could further develop the maturity, tolerance, patience, and breadth that are essential characteristics of a general officer. In Saigon, I found that someone at ABC had let on that I'd talked, and a number of old acquaintances in the press corps came by to get interviews of their own. I hadn't planned to go further than the issues and answers thing, but now I figured if I was going to stand in the door, I might as well go all the way. Besides, in a manner of speaking, some of these correspondents, among them Dan Sutherland of the Christian Science Monitor, Kevin Buckley of Newsweek, and Rick Marin of the Associated Press, were old war buddies. In the case of Rick Marin, he'd actually been a first of the 101st Trooper when he came over in 1965, took his discharge in Vietnam, and stayed on as a reporter. On the job, he'd received 8 separate wounds. So I gave a few more interviews with the assurance from all that their release would be no earlier than the beginning of July, after I'd left Vietnam for the last time. Then I spent a couple of wild days gambling and partying with John Westmoreland, and then hopped onto a plane to Australia for a 2-week leave before I came back to Vietnam for my final out-processing. But I hadn't been in Sydney a week when there was a knock on the door of Jenny's apartment. It was a uniformed U.S. Navy officer. "Someone is mad at you, Colonel," he said, and handed me a cable that his commander had received. "Request that you contact Colonel David H. Hackworth and inform him that upon termination of his leave, he is to return to Saigon. Upon his arrival, he is to report to Inspector General Mac V to provide information in connection with an investigation of facts and circumstances regarding his allegations." Obviously, someone had jumped the gun and published my comments. Even so, what the Army was calling allegations, I knew were facts, and the Army couldn't hang me for telling the truth. I'd even had Judge Cooney check with 4 Mac V JAG lawyers, including one from JustPow, the Public Affairs and Information Office at Mac V, who, having been briefed on the basic thrust of what I had to say, all maintained I was well within my constitutional rights to say it. Still, the tone of the cable was pretty serious, and I figured whatever was going to happen, I might as well get it over with. So I didn't wait until the end of my leave. Instead, I caught the first plane back to Vietnam. At the morning briefing on the day following Hack's TV appearance, the ACSI, Assistant Chief of Staff Intelligence, asked, "Where did this guy get his commission?" I replied, "He received a battlefield commission in Korea." Another officer stated, "He has abandoned his family, you know." Another general officer remarked, "They should take away his retirement pension." All this left me with a very sick, sick feeling. Colonel Wyatt J. Mitchell, United States Army retired, Staff Officer, Office of the Assistant Chief of Staff, Intelligence, 1971. I think many people felt the same way I did about the interview. We didn't feel that it was necessarily wrong for him to do it, but we felt kind of tainted by some of the things he said about our behavior in Vietnam. We recognized enough truth, but we felt at the same time he was painting everyone with the same brush. He was using a shotgun when he should have been using a rifle. Colonel Henrik D. Lund, United States Army retired, Battalion Commander, Special Forces, Fort Bragg, 1971. The view here is that Colonel Hackworth represents a unique case for which there are very few precedents in the Army's long history. I don't think we have had his like since George A. Custer. Back channel from Lieutenant General William McCaffrey, Deputy Commanding General, USARV, to General Bruce Palmer, Jr., Vice Chief of Staff, September 1971. A distinguished visitor on a military aircraft was anyone of the rank of full colonel or above. Being a distinguished visitor gave you the right to be the first to board an aircraft as well as the first to deplane. Having never been into protocol, however, when we arrived at Tansanut, I waited in line inside the cabin for my turn to get off the aircraft. This allowed me to postpone meeting the crowd of reporters waiting outside, whom I could hear repeatedly calling my name. It was a good move. By the time I finally made my way down the ramp, they'd either decided Hackworth wasn't on the aircraft or left me alone because they didn't know what Hackworth looked like, and I looked too young to be a bird colonel. In any event, I only had eyes for my old friend Frenchy Fry, who stood on the side of the ramp halfway down. "Three guys in khaki at the bottom of the ramp are IG," he said carefully without moving his lips like a convict in the yard. "They're waiting for you. Do not identify yourself. Go directly to our jeep. The shit has hit the fan." My heart froze. I saw the 44th Zone jeep parked a short distance away. When I hit the bottom of the ramp, I walked purposely to it, as did Fry. It was a clean getaway. Back at the Saigon safe house, Frenchy gave me all the facts that were available from his MACV contacts. It seemed that the first article, Dan Sutherland's piece, had been published even as I'd gotten onto the plane to Australia. The others, Les Kevin Buckley and Nick Prophet's Newsweek item, followed within days. The same day Sutherland's article appeared, ABC had begun broadcasting excerpts of the Tuckner interview to plug the upcoming Issues and Answers program, and Issues and Answers itself had played in the U.S. this very day. Frenchy had called the team at Khao Lan just before I arrived and was told things weren't too good. Apparently, the Inspector General's office had descended upon Team 50 en masse. Mere weeks after we'd been given a clean IG bill of health, now the word was they were digging, looking for something wrong, something irregular, so they could throw the book at me, keep me in Vietnam, hold up my retirement, even court-martial me. The calm, cool way Frenchy presented all the information he'd collected did little to quell my growing anxiety. Before long, I had an overwhelming fear, one that covered all possible contingencies, from the IG people abducting me forever and ever, to an enemy sniper taking a single lethal shot at me in a Saigon street. So I called Nick George over at ABC and asked for some flank security. The bureau chief and ex-World War II infantryman was totally supportive. He said he would assign a camera team to me, whose entire mission would be to go everywhere I went and, if necessary, film whatever happened. Feeling a little safer, I rang the IG office at MACV. "I understand you guys have been looking for me. I just got off the plane. Must have missed you. What's up?" They wanted to see me right away, but by then it was dark and after curfew, so I convinced them to wait until the next day. "General Abrams wants to see you at 0800 at MACV headquarters," they intoned. "Be there." I was, and so was my film crew, but even with them, I was terrified, and the clusters of soldiers I saw hanging out the windows of Disneyland East smiling, calling, "Right on," and flashing me the peace sign did little to assuage my fear. The ABC crew went as far with me as they could, but they could not go farther than MACV's front door. Inside, I was informed General Abrams no longer wanted to see me, and that I was to leave my phone number and go back to my quarters. I would be contacted. The last thing I was told was that I was not to give any more statements until I returned to the United States. I went outside and gave that statement to ABC, which duly filmed it, and then I went back to the safe house. Later that day, I received a call to come back to MACV for a talk with the IG. By then, I'd managed to put the cap on my worst-case scenarios and did not take the ABC crew along. My talk with the IG men would prove to be 4 days and nights of on-and-off interrogation. I had to go through transcripts of the Issues and Answers program and each of the published articles with the pencil, initialing what I'd said or indicating, no, these are not my words, or yes, they are, but they're out of context, as appropriate. I also had to give specifics for each of my allegations, including those concerning the body count systems encouraging false reporting and the fact that the Vietnamese had been lousy in 1965 and there'd been little improvement since. 15 years later, these and other of my allegations would be accepted as among the basic facts of the Vietnam War, but this was no help at the time. My comments about the disaster on Hamburger Hill and the Sari Arvin attack into Laos were dismissed on the basis that I had no direct knowledge of them. That is, I hadn't been on the ground. This was despite my having read after-action reports and or having talked to the participants soon afterwards in both cases in the Slam Marshall vein, which had been thoroughly legitimized in our chief of staff-backed Vietnam primer, which was now considered part of Army literature for Vietnam. Once I got into the swing of the questioning and realized I was dealing with a kangaroo court, I began to take it all a little easier. The only time I got scared was on the second day when, off the record, the IG told me a little story about a major general in the German army who'd been paid $25,000 to blow the whistle on his organization. Then the IG said he had information that I'd deposited $5,000 in my Pentagon bank account in late May and asked if I had been paid by Newsweek or the newspapers to speak out. I had not. But I also had no idea where all that money in my account came from. My initial thought was I'd been framed. It was not until I got out of there and called Tim Grattan that I found out the money had been deposited by a realtor who'd sold my house in Bellevue, Washington. I knew I had to get the hell out of Vietnam. If these guys knew what was happening in my bank account in the United States, though the fact that they did was totally illegal. Later, the president of the bank would explain in a letter of apology that an inexperienced teller had mistakenly released the information to an Army investigator on the same day Dan Sutherland's Christian Science Monitor article was published, who'd stated he was acting on orders from the top. It wasn't going to take them long to uncover the shallowly buried irregularities in the zone. One hot jeep would be enough to allow them to whack a criminal charge on me, and then they could keep me in country as long as they damn well pleased. And besides worrying about that, and about being court-martialed sometime down the track, I was worried about becoming a terrorist statistic right now. Film crew or no film crew, how easy would it be for there to be an accident, not unlike in kind the one I'd had with W.O. Phillips in my chopper the day before I left Khao Lan? After 4 days, it became too much. I told the MAC VIG people to shit or get off the pot. They could let me go home as scheduled, or they could press charges, but no way were they going to keep me in limbo, virtually under house arrest, forever. I told them I'd already spoken to the press, that I would have no problem doing it again, and anyway, how would it look to the American public if, after 4 years of serving my country in Vietnam, now, as a result of my beliefs and of my telling the truth, the Army was not allowing me to go home? Shortly thereafter, word came from General Abrams to let me go. And the word couldn't have come at a moment too soon. Late that afternoon, just as I was leaving for the airport, John Westmoreland and I did a routine check of my Jeep, which was parked in front of his house, and we found a frag grenade lodged under the front seat. The cotter pin was pulled, and only the way it was wedged under the seat kept the firing pin held back. Had we not found it, the slightest bounce or sudden stop as we drove the vehicle to the airport would have jarred the grenade and caused it to fire. "Goodbye, troublemaker," sang my paranoid brain. Of course, incidents like this, generally the random work of South Vietnamese cowboys and VC terrorists, were not uncommon occurrences in Saigon, and in all likelihood the grenade under my jeep seat was a coincidental event to my predicament. But it got my complete attention. We safed the grenade and hauled ass to the airport, where I met up with Hancock, Willis, Schutte, and Frenchie Fry, who were going home too, on the same plane. All of us but Hancock were overdue, but it was Frenchie Fry, the master organizer, who had coordinated our simultaneous flight from the cuckoo's nest. Frenchy had also organized a much-appreciated order that allowed me to wear civilian clothes for the trip home, and as we got onto the airplane, I was sure I'd never been so relieved in my life. But just as the hostess was closing the door, I saw a light colonel dashing up the ramp holding a thick folder. I froze. They'd found something at Khao Lan they could really nail me for, and it would be worth all the bad press they'd take. I could feel myself getting ready to bolt when the guy raced up to my seat. "Colonel Hackworth?" he asked breathlessly. "Yeah," I responded. "Get off this plane. You're under arrest," my mind heard him say. "Here are your records," he replied. Then he lowered his voice to a whisper. "You'll be needing them." It was nice the way he said it, and his look was one of admiration. Friends like that, I was going to need too. "Dear Colonel Hackworth, I want to tell you that we have received a greater volume of mail concerning your appearance than for any other guest whom we have presented this year. All of the letters were highly complimentary." Letter from Peggy Whedon, producer, Issues and Answers, 6 July, 1971. Dear Issues and Answers, the interview with Colonel Hackworth is, I think, the most important thing you have done this year. His emotional involvement with the soldiers and his country is akin to that of a mother who has sweated out the draft with three sons. His patriotism is, I fear, about to be misunderstood by the flag wavers. He deserves our gratitude and our prayers. Letter from Mrs. H. E., Rice Lake, Wisconsin, 27 June, 1971. Dear gentlemen, I can't tell you how happy I am to hear just one voice in the wilderness crying out the truth. As a former combat veteran of Okinawa, I appreciate it even more. However, gentlemen, please don't let the Pentagon hurt this man. We need men like him desperately. Letter from Dr. R. F., Glen Cove, Long Island, New York, to Issues and Answers, 27 June, 1971. The plane stopped in Japan, and no one pulled me off. We stopped in Anchorage, too, and no one pulled me off there, either. Even though that very day an article I'd written called The Army Leadership Failure in Vietnam had been published in the Washington Post and syndicated around the country, making angry people just a whole lot angrier. Finally, we got to San Francisco, where Jenny Bates, who'd flown in from Sydney to meet me, and the press were waiting. My civilian gear allowed me to escape the media, and Jenny and I headed straight up to Tim Grattan's, so that the next morning I could zip over to Fort Lewis and sign out of the Army. Little did I know, by the time I arrived at Lewis, my records had been flagged and my terminal leave canceled. Fortunately for me, Fort Lewis didn't know it either, because when the telex bearing this information came through, it just so happened that all the luck in the world had converged on the Fort Lewis Message Center on my behalf. In what had to have been a 1 in 10 million chance, the duty officer that night was none other than Captain B.J. Jensen, late of the 7th of the 1st Cav, my beanie-propellered aviation liaison officer in the zone. When B.J. saw the message, he just disappeared it, and no one was the wiser. Even with the reprieve, my brief visit to Lewis was plenty tense. Yes, the young studs in the administration building were flashing the V sign and saying stuff like, "Right on, sir," and "Thanks for telling the truth," just as they had at MACV in Saigon. But as I waited to see the G1 colonel who'd be signing me out, a smiling clerk sidled up beside me and whispered, "Watch out for the colonel, sir. He's working for the establishment against you." "Thanks," I said, truly surprised. It hadn't occurred to me. I'd known this colonel for years, and I wouldn't have thought he'd be less than friendly. And I was right. The G1 was all smiles, and he ushered me into his office. "Just sign out here, Hack," he said. So I signed the papers that began my 2 months of terminal leave, after which I hoped would come retirement. With the formalities out of the way, the colonel, still as friendly as could be, asked, with the height of casualness, "So, where are you going from here?" I looked at his smiling face and remembered the smiling face of the clerk outside. "He's working for the establishment against you." "Well," I said, "a good friend of mine has this yacht in San Francisco, and he's going to sail down around the Caribbean for 4 or 5 months. I thought that was a pretty good way of working the war out of my system, so I'm going along." "Sounds good." "Should be." It was a whopper, but a good one. I could see it now. The U.S. Navy and Coast Guard checking every pleasure yacht and military installation all over the Caribbean in an effort to track me down while I was up with Tim in Seattle or bopping around the USA. It was not that I really believed I'd survive the 2 full months of terminal leave without getting caught, but I needed to delay it as long as possible. I had to know first what the Army had on me and what they planned to do, so I could develop a counterplan. The evidence against me was mounting all too quickly. At the end of my last interrogation in Vietnam, Colonel Robert M. Cook, the MAC VIG, had said, "The object of the IG business is to get things in perspective. If we wanted to get vindictive, we could go down and go through your files at Khao Lan, and if we were after your ass, we could find all those petty things, but that's not the name of the game." A less accurate statement I was never to hear. They'd already violated my constitutional rights by going into my bank account in the United States. They went to American Express, too, I soon found out, which gave Army investigators my complete files after the investigators promised not to release the source. And down in the Delta, they were digging up every damn thing they could. Pressure on team members was applied, at times